The reading from Bhagavad Gita, as it is, the fourth chapter, which is called Transcendental Knowledge, and this text 18. One who sees inaction, this is hard to do if you don't have it on the page. One who sees inaction, that is to say, akarma. The word karma is action, so one who sees akarma in karma. Akarma, ya pasyet. Pasyet means one to see, one who sees. So within action, and conversely, action in inaction, is intelligent among men, and he is in the transcendental position, although engaged in all sorts of activities. So akarmani, akarma, ya pasyet. One who sees akarma, even when it looks like karma. The word karma means action, so akarma. And akarmani chakarmaya, and within akarma, inaction, he sees karma. That person is called buddhiman. Buddhiman. Buddhi means intelligence, the faculty of discrimination. Manusheshu, among human beings. That person is yukta. Prabhupada translates here in the transcendental position. But yukta comes from the same word as yoga. Yuj. It means he's connected with transcendence. Connected. Yukta can mean connected, really. He's connected with transcendence. And kritsna karma krit. And although he krita karma, he performs karma, kritsna, all kinds of karma. Still, he's intelligent. Here's Prabhupada's purport. A person acting in Krishna consciousness is naturally free from the bonds of karma. His activities are all performed for Krishna. Therefore, he does not enjoy or suffer any of the effects of work. Consequently, he is intelligent in human society, even though he is engaged in all sorts of activities for Krishna. Akarma means without reaction to work. The impersonalist ceases fruitive activities out of fear, so that the resultant action may not be a stumbling block on the path of self-realization. But the personalist knows rightly his position as the eternal servitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, he engages himself in the activities of Krishna consciousness. Because everything is done for Krishna, he enjoys only transcendental happiness in the discharge of this service. Those who are engaged in this process are known to be without desire for personal sense gratification. The sense of eternal servitorship to Krishna makes one immune to all sorts of reactionary elements of work. So let's go back a little bit and review what's been going. Come before here. Starting back at text 16. Well, before that even, Krishna's already explained that he is not affected by any work. Although Krishna himself performs activities, he is still transcendental. Nor do I aspire for the fruits of action. He's not working to get something. Why should God need anything? He's full and he's complete in himself. Yet we see he acts. Why? Well, it's just out of sheer overflowing happiness. Just like somebody when they're really, really happy, they just jump up and down and dance. So basically on the same way, Krishna does things. Not that it's just the expression of his fullness rather than He's not working to make money or trying to impress anybody or anything. He's just exuberant. So he says, anyone who understands this about me does not become entangled in fruitive work. And therefore, he says in the next verse, you should do your karma with this understanding about me as it was done in the past. So now he turns to this question about karma on text 16. Even those who are kavi, kavi means learned, kavayo, they are bewildered about what is karma and what is akarma. What is karma? Kim karma? Kim akarma iti? What is karma? Iti means like quotation marks. What is karma and what is akarma? They don't know for sure. So now he says, I'm going to tell you what is karma. And you shall understand it and be liberated. So here now it says that those who are wise understand this. So later on, again, the question of karma comes up. And in the eighth chapter, Krishna defines it for Arjuna as actions that produce material bodies, or so let's say future material bodies. And what kind of action are those? Those for which we have a desire for the karma phala, the fruit of the when you go to work and you do your job because there's a fruit, there's a paycheck. You work because of the paycheck. No pay. If you're not interested in the paycheck, you wouldn't work. So almost everybody in this world, whatever they're doing, they want something. And they want to enjoy the fruits of their work. So this is karma. And it produces bondage. It makes us identify with the material body and become attached to things in this world. And when we act in this way, even when we get what we want, almost everybody wants more. It's very, very rare that somebody says, I want to make $1 billion. And when they get $1 billion, they stop. And they say, that's enough. Suddenly, $2 billion looks good. So people, once the attachment is there, they just keep on going. So that's karma. Then there's another word called vikarma. The prefix vi in Sanskrit is a kind of all-purpose intensifier. And so strictly, in a very strict sense, karma means duties that are prescribed in the Vedas. You do your work according to the direction of scripture. And you don't do forbidden things. So really karma means kind of pious activity. If you do business, you're careful not to cheat anyone, not to commit any crimes, to pay all your taxes and to give in charity. Nobody does this, but anyway, this is a little rare. Almost every person who does business cheats. Everywhere it's laid down what you ought to do and how you should do it. That's in the strict sense of the word is karma. Vikarma, it means you don't care. You disobey the rules and regulations. You lie, you cheat, you steal. Become successful and celebrated everywhere in that way. That's called vikarma. And then there's what is called akarma. Now, this is people who are interested in transcendence are interested in akarma because they know that both karma and vikarma bind us to the material world. The result of karma is that one takes birth again in the material world, but it's nice. If one is born with good looks, from a good family, has money, inherits money, gets a good education, this is considered to be the result of previous good karma in past life. Conversely, if somebody has the opposite of those things, or suffers things like chronic legal problems and so on, this is vikarma. Really good karma takes one to the material heavens, svarga, places of superior sense enjoyment. Prabhupada calls them the heavenly planets of Indra and the demigods. And there's far superior the material satisfaction than we can even grasp here. That's different from the kingdom of God. Kingdom of God is a place where there's devotional service. And while in the heavens people are pious, nevertheless there's intense enjoyment. There's very beautiful women, apsaras, they're called. Prabhupada calls them heavenly society girls. That means like a courtesan, so something like a prostitute, but a very high class. Prostitute, heavenly, the apsaras, sometimes he calls them angels. And there's fantastic music, the Gandharvas play, make music and do artistic work. And there's even an intoxicant there called somaras, which is kind of a heavenly intoxicant. So it's here in the material world, at least for my generation, the big three were drugs, sex, and rock and roll. So basically in the heavenly planets, you have a very elevated version of drugs, sex, and rock and roll. That's all a sense gratification. So the good karma will bring these material rewards. But you still have to take birth again in the material world. You get good karma. When you go to the heavenly planets, you have so much good karma already here. And as you stay there, you're using it up. And when it's all gone, you come back down. So it's temporary. And again, you're in this mrityu samsara, the cycle of repeated birth and death. Bad karma means you suffer, much worse. But when you're on the platform of karma, you can always end up doing something wrong, and again you have to suffer. So from a spiritual point of view, they're both bad. So those who want to get free from birth and death in the material world, they don't want to perform any karma at all, not karma, not vikarma. From a spiritual point of view, they look the same. In fact, Prabhupada compares them to dung, to stool. And you go on the roads in India, at least in the countryside, there's always cow dung on the road. And some of it has been dried by the sun, and it's dry dung, dry stool. And some of it's fresh, and it's all wet. And you step in the wet stuff, it's a nasty experience, and the dry stuff doesn't really bother you. So Prabhupada said that, good karma is like dry stool, dry dung, and bad karma is like wet dung. So you can say, oh, this is good dung and this is bad dung. But he says, after all, it's all dung. So this is from the spiritual point of view. It looks all the same. So people who are transcendentalists, Prabhupada uses this term all the time. They want to get out of the cycle of birth and death permanently in the material world. They're transcendentalists. And so they aim at akarma, not to do anything, not to create any karma. So in many cases, it is sometimes understood that one should just strive for inaction, not doing anything. Like, for example, there are many famous cases where sages perform great austerities and penances. They perform yoga by doing yoga breathing and other things. They can slow down their heartbeat and almost slow down their digestion, so they basically don't move. They don't do anything. They eat. Sometimes they say they live on air. And that only, you know, take a breath every once every so many years. And so they're trying to stop action because of their fear of karma. And in various ways, this is the goal of these people. And they think in the liberated state, there's no activity at all. They see that all the activities in the material world, whether pious or impious, cause bondage. So they think that the transcendent state is just to be inert. There are no actions to be performed. But here what Krishna is doing is basically he's criticizing that view, how to really understand. So he says that in the previous verse, he says that it is difficult to understand. To understand the intricacies of the complications of work is very difficult. One needs to understand what is karma and what is vikarma and what is akarma. He said, and this is very difficult. And now he says something that sounds quite maybe contradictory, that if one is actually buddhi, he has intelligence. Intelligence means this ability, a kind of higher discrimination. So if one is actually intelligent then and become actually wise, that person sees that it's possible to be performing activities in the general sense of the word karma and is still not producing any reaction whatsoever. So that is, he can see inaction in somebody's action. And conversely, he can see that somebody who seems to be doing nothing is actually, there's some karma there. And so how do we explain it? Well, Krishna does this by connecting it in the Bhagavad Gita with devotional service. Otherwise, it's all kinds of very difficult to understand. When I was in the university, I studied many different religions. And in Chinese religion, like in Taoism, Taoistic philosophy, they have this also idea, they call it wei wu wei, acting without acting. Acting and not acting at the same time. So that notion is there. But when you hear people try to explain what it is, it just dissolves into mystification. Because somehow or other you're supposed to be industrious in your activities and at the same time completely without any care for what happens, or completely self-sufficient. And how do you get there? Well, it's just not explicable. These people like this, they can go so far, and they get kind of up to the edge of devotional service, but because they haven't gotten any further, it's very hard to understand. But really, it's very simple that one acts to serve Krishna. Krishna is not a material person. He's transcendent, and he has his things that he's doing. I mentioned one thing he does is just out of exuberance and happiness and just having a good time. And the other thing that Krishna is very concerned to do is not for himself, but for the spirit souls who are suffering in the material world. On the one hand, the number of living entities in the material world is very, very tiny compared to the whole number. In Krishna's kingdom, they're uncountable living entities. And because they're in the spiritual world, they have a full and rich interactive relationship in one way or another with the Lord. And the Lord is enjoying exchanges of love with each of them personally. And a very small deviant minority is here in this material world. And so, why should Krishna care? If a person has millions of dollars, he's not going to miss 10. He doesn't go after the $10. It won't feel their absence. In one sense, Krishna doesn't feel the absence of these people in the material world. Those of us in the material world, we are the ones that on our own have decided to turn away from Krishna. Krishna Bahirmukhi. We have turned our faces away from Krishna. Krishna doesn't want it to happen. Krishna is all powerful, yet things happen that he doesn't want to happen. If things happened entirely as Krishna wanted, there would be no material world with its repeated birth and death and so on. But at the same time, the living entities have their freedom, their little bit of freedom, and some scope to exercise it. And so those that turn away and want to, basically become competitors with Krishna. Why should he be God? Why can't I be God? This is the material world. It has this deluding energy where we can become hypnotized into thinking enchanted that here I am in this world and it's laid out all before me for me to enjoy and exploit and there is no God and so on. This is called Maya, and it is Krishna's energy that covers us so we can exercise, to some extent, our independence from Krishna. Krishna doesn't want us to be separate from him. Although we have turned away from him, he has not turned away from us. He didn't pay us back in kind. And so the material world is so arranged as in one way or other, without interfering with our freedom, to bring us all back. And for that purpose, Krishna also appears again and again in the material world and sends his devotees and tries to keep religious principles established so that people can go back to Godhead. So in this case, he's acting really for our sake. As I said, he has so many souls there. But the nature of his love is such that he still wants us back. And he's still you might say, misses the relationship with the people in the material world. It's natural in the material world, if you love somebody, you want reciprocation. So your love can be more and more fully expressed and grow and develop. So in this way, Krishna also wants to have reciprocation. So therefore, he also has what he wants done in this world. So for example, when he in this age of Kali, he descends as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, a really big effort to bring back fallen souls. And we come under the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this is what we know what Krishna wants. And we know what would please him. And so when we act in such a way, simply to satisfy Krishna's desires, that creates no karma. So of course you have to know what Krishna wants. He says in the Bhagavad Gita, in order to help us establish a relationship with him, anyone who offers me with love a leaf, a fruit, a flower, a water, I will accept it. And so he will not accept a beefsteak. If he says, this is what I want, then you want to offer him what pleases him. So you do that, and then he accepts it. When one cooks for Krishna, there's no karma. So that is inaction. Let's say that the devas, there are witnesses to all our actions. Everything we do in the universe is seen and in fact recorded. There we have no secrets really. So let's say that the devas who do these things, they have a kind of karmic meter. They can see how much karma is being produced. There's some little readout, a dial, or some digital readout, how much karma. So let's say there's some food market, and people are there buying food to cook and eat and enjoy. And so in that supermarket, that karma meter is for every individual is running pretty high. But say a devotee goes into the same supermarket and is buying food to offer to Krishna, fruits and vegetables and so on, milk. There's no karma. The karma meter registers nothing, even though the devotee is acting. He's not producing any. So this is how it works in this way, that we can serve Krishna and still be in the transcendent position. So long as we do it to please Krishna or to please Krishna's devotees, those who are to serve Krishna, usually what we have to do is serve a devotee who's serving Krishna. Like we are all serving Srila Prabhupada. We had contact with Krishna, but we had contact with Prabhupada, and then we serve him. And then I can serve many times removed, and so that Krishna's mission and activities are enhanced in this way. As far as seeing action and inaction, well, a person who has a very strong desire for liberation because of a fear of the suffering of the material world, and that's the limit of their thing, that's also a kind of karma. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is said, bhukti mukti siddhi kama. Those people who are kama means lust, a strong material desire. For bhukti means sense enjoyment, mukti means liberation, And siddhi means those kind of mystic perfections you get from doing yoga. So the desire for mukti or liberation can also be a selfish desire. And on the one hand, it's more advanced that a person realizes that in this material world there is no happiness. Although, all we have to do is open up our eyes for 5 seconds, and you can see in the material world there is no happiness. Really, that's all it takes. But most people are going to the world with their eyes shut tight because they don't want to see. But if you just really, a little bit of the spell of Maya breaks, and you can see there are no prospects for happiness in this material world. And it's actually pretty easy to prove. Material happiness, we seek this by bringing our senses into contact with the sense objects, and when we do, we experience some kind of pleasure. And then we think, oh, the way to happiness is just to keep that pleasure going or to increase it or so on, because of this, what the Bhagavad Gita calls samsparsaja bhoga, that pleasure that arises from the contact between the senses and the objects. So this is what people are trying to do. Now you will notice that in the material world, the contact between the senses and the objects is in fact not very secure. There's this distressing tendency for that pleasure to come to an end one way or another, sooner or later. So people are always worried. Most of my material happiness, for example, depends on having money. So I can lose my job. As soon as I want to acquire and keep things in the material world, immediately there's anxiety because of loss or the possibility of loss. I'm 16 years old and I fall in love with a beautiful girl. Oh, does my anxiety increase like crazy? Is she going to like me tomorrow? Is she going to get interested in another guy? And they do. And so there's so much anxiety. And so inevitably we have this experience that we put our senses in contact with the object, we feel pleasure, and it comes to an end. The more we enjoy it, the worse we feel. This is, as Sigmund Freud has a book in English, the title is Civilization and Its Discontents. And the first 50 pages or so is a systematic analysis of why material happiness is not possible. It's quite a thorough discussion. So we have this experience that this pleasure, this happiness comes to an end. We form these relationships in the world for happiness, and they break. And death can be defined as the ultimate failure to perpetuate relationships. And that's why the fear of death permeates everything. In the material world, if we are bound to material happiness, with every spoonful of material happiness we eat, there's a nice dose of dread and fear built in. We're so used to the taste of it, we don't even notice anymore. But if it would go away, we'd say, wow, what happened? So when that happiness comes to an end, whatever it may be that we have, how do we feel? Well, we feel really bad. We feel let down. We feel depressed. We cry. We mourn. So many things. And so if you ask somebody, why did you feel bad when your pleasure came to an end? And they'll say, well, I wanted it to keep on going. And then if you ask them, well, how long did you want it to keep on going for? And they'll say, well, how long can I have? Forever? And so you can see that actually our real desire is for some kind of happiness or pleasure that does not come to an end. That's what we really want. And we're looking for that in a place where everything is temporary. A QED, I mean, that's the how for just nice. It's an incompatible situation. And actually that desire for eternal happiness really has its root in the fact that we are eternal living beings. It's still our latent memory of our original spiritual condition. When we turn away from Krishna and fall into the material world, we suffer a huge trauma. Sometimes people look back for our suffering for some trauma in their childhood, or even some psychiatrist thought there was a birth trauma when you were expelled from the paradise of the womb. But you have to go way back. The real trauma is when we came to the material world from the spiritual world and we lost three things, Sat, Chit, and Ananda. We are Sat, and now everything is Asat, temporary. We are eternal, but we are in a place where everything is temporary. We are actually Chit, full of consciousness and knowledge, but now our consciousness and knowledge runs in very narrow streams. And Ananda, we're full of bliss. And now whatever little drops we get here are just frustrating, because they don't fulfill our desires. So that's what we're suffering from. So the connection with Krishna, even though we're in the material world and with material bodies, those very activities that we were doing for sense gratification, if we do those activities in the service of Krishna, instead of binding us, they liberate us. Narada Muni gives the comparison to the traditional cure in India for loose bowels or diarrhea caused by drinking too much milk. The remedy is yogurt, which is milk in another form. So there's a kind of a homeopathic principle that the same thing that caused the disease, if that same agent is therapeutically modified, it will cure it. So the things we do in Krishna consciousness or Krishna service, if we did those things in the material world, would cause our bondage. If we do them for Krishna, the same activities cause our liberation. Like singing and dancing every night, but all the cities, people go out and they sing and dance one way or another. We sing and dance too. When I was a child, I knew people who belonged to strict Baptist churches, and singing and dancing were not allowed. They were very strict about this. But here we sing and dance. But we do it in connection with Krishna. Eating is the activity by which we're most deeply entangled with material nature, in a very basic, instinctual way, engaged in sense gratification. If we don't eat, we'll die. And yet every bite gets us deeper entangled in material nature, and all that karma. Not only animals are killed, but even when you eat vegetables, you plow a field, how many animals are being killed just when you plow a field? And even if you eat fruit, it's not so innocent either. Where does your fruit come from? Well, it's usually some third world country your banana comes from. And how are those laborers being treated? And what's the history of these banana republics and so on? So there's karma everywhere. Even if you're a vegetarian, not as bad as if you're unnecessarily killing, but still, any eating involves killing and damage. And so therefore, one cooks for Krishna and takes the remnants of food stuff, then there's no karma. So this is the remedial practice of devotional service. Those people who want to escape from the material world because of its suffering, that's good to know that. Prabhupada says that one should be realistic about this material world. Krishna lists as the items of knowledge in the 13th chapter, knowledge of the evils of birth, death, old age, and disease, janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi, dukkha, doshana, darshanam. You have to know that. He lists it because people don't seem to notice. And these are considered to be the real problems, birth, death, old age, and disease. Because if you want to be happy in this world, solve the death problem. And don't get old. Stop at 18, max. Maximum. Don't get any older than 18. And people are always trying to somehow or other solve the old age problem, solve the disease problem, solve the death problem either, but it's all fairy tales. I remember there was all a kind of hype because they had discovered that in living cells, there's a kind of a chemical switch, and when that switch trips, the cell starts to grow old. And so these researchers are thinking, aha, all we have to do is figure out a way to, you know, put it back. And so they actually got some mice that they could do that in, so the mice didn't grow old. Then they're on their way to the Nobel Prize, you know. But all the mice died of cancer. Cancer instead. So back to the drawing board, you know. I think these things are not so... You do one thing like that, you create another problem here, as we see everywhere with too much. So one should get out of the material world, but the idea of just rejecting it wholesale, saying it's all evil, of saying it's all bad, that's also incorrect. And aversion is really just the other side of the coin of attachment. And you're still caught up in duality. So, for example, there are people that want to enjoy the world, like the materialists, and the people like the gnanis who want to reject the world, those kinds of transcendentalists. Who want to reject the world or renounce it. But Prabhupada points out, first of all, the world belongs to Krishna. It's not ours to enjoy. We don't own it anyway. It doesn't belong to us. And therefore, when I say I renounce everything, we never had it to renounce. So we neither try to enjoy it, nor do we try to renounce it. But simply, we engage ourselves in everything in Krishna's service. As we do that, the spell of Maya starts to evaporate, and we see reality. We see everywhere the person who is in our heart, who is always wishing us well, is in fact in everything and behind everywhere. The universe becomes a different place. It's not this scary, terrifying world where we don't know what's going on or what's happening. It's not like, you know, Pascal, the silence of infinite spaces terrifies me, he wrote. It's not like that at all. Everything you see in relationship to Krishna. Prabhupada even said, don't see a tree, see Krishna. Not that the tree is God, but you have to see this, everything as belonging to Krishna, as being Krishna's energy, and as being pervaded everywhere by Krishna. That's a different world from the world of Maya, and it's the real world. And so we began to actually live our lives rather than walking around in a stupor or a daze of not facing reality because it looks so horrible, is on the material basis. So that's why it's important to understand what is action and what is inaction and how to act in a way that leads us to full Krishna consciousness. So much so that the whole material world becomes, as it says, as good as Vaikuntha. It's for a devotee who's fully engaged in Krishna service. He doesn't even want to get out because it's as fully satisfying as the spiritual world. He just wants to say to Krishna, wherever you want me to serve you, now go. Okay. All right, thank you. Any questions or comments? Are we now wise among men? Yeah?
One of the major problems we face in this world is difficulty with the mind arising from mental disturbance. So how does the process of devotional service, how does the devotee see the mind? How does he work with it?
Yeah.
And maybe how is the intelligence also connected?
Yeah, that's a very important question. Yeah, Bhagavatam says in Kali Yuga that people are, above all, always disturbed. That disturbance means the mind. And really, to deal properly with material nature, we should really start with that part of material nature to which we are the most closely linked, and that is our minds. In the Bhagavad Gita, the body is called the kshetra, the field of activities for the living entity. See, normally we think this is where I end and here's my environment out here. And we have, of course, this movement to try to clean up the environment. But really, our body is our environment. First of all, there's this gross body. It's called the sthula sharira, the gross body. But there's a second layer, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, the psychic body, made of technically manas, buddhi, ahankara, these three things. And so our own mind is our most intimate environment. When we say we are not the body, the first thing to know is we are not the mind. And we have to know this too in order to deal with it. Really, it's important for spiritual discipline to understand this, that I am not my mind. It's very good news. because we have prayers that were Raghunath Das Goswami, Lokanath Swami, they addressed the mind as someone else, my dear brother within, like a roommate. And what has happened is that we decide to become devotees. And that really happens on the platform of buddhi, of intelligence. So in that way, we decide to become devotees. We are devotees. Our mind is not. The mind is the place of this classical Pavlovian conditioning. It's all programmed in a certain way for sense gratification. It's the realm of habits, of settled habits. And everybody knows how hard it is to break a habit, a bad habit.
If we've ever had to give up cigarettes, it's really, really tough. Because even you get away from the cigarette, and then you know you want to have a cup of coffee, then immediately the desire for a cigarette, then you have to give up the coffee too. And so people have a tough thing. You have to change a lot of things to give up your habits. So we have the habits of sense gratification that are in our mind. So as a consequence, when one embarks on the spiritual path, we seem like we are a divided person. I remember when I was first becoming devotee, my friends from college would come and see me, and they said, "This is not good for you." They said, "You used to be so together." And now you look like really, you know, tense. Well, it's true. I used to be together because whatever my mind wanted, whatever desires, I was just enthusiastic to do it. And now I was engaged in a severe inner struggle to deny these things. So naturally, I didn't look too together. So we will go through that stage. Once we have conquered the mind, then we're together again, but we're on another platform now. But in the intermediate stage, it's very awkward and very difficult. And then, of course, even on a material platform, so many people are not mentally healthy. There are so many disturbances from, I don't know, just bad upbringings, I suppose, and all kinds of other disturbances due to things you can't control, wars and all this kind of stuff. And very few people have what used to be a secure childhood. It's just the conditions. Even if your parents love you very much, you don't see them that much because the modern conditioners both have to work and you're being raised by strangers. And even if the parents love us, they can't really, you know, spend time. And they try to say, okay, you know, you get 50 minutes a week and we'll try to make it quality time. But that doesn't fool a kid, you know. Oh, it's very difficult. There's a great deal of mental disturbance. So that's why, Prabhupada said that even a mentally disturbed person can be cured by treatment of transcendental sound. So the real thing about controlling the mind, to work on this, is really properly with chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. And I particularly think the activity of japa is therapeutic, if you do it right. If we do it carelessly, it can become another bad habit, doing it in the wrong way. And the right way is described in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says that one should fix the attention on the self in a very steadily way. And whenever the mind wanders, you bring it back under the control of the self. It should be, our attention should be like a candle flame in a windless place. When it wanders, you bring it back. So for ourselves, this process is a little easier because we concentrate the mind on the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Which is not just, it's like some people meditate on a candle flame, for which there's no reciprocation, but the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is Krishna. But the basic thing is that one has to chant while trying to give up offenses. And of course, in the list of offenses, one is called pramadaha, which is inattentiveness. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur tells us that this inattentiveness is the seedbed from which all the offenses grow. And that if we don't deal with this one, we will not be successful in dealing with any of the others. So that's where it comes in. We try to concentrate on the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and we'll notice in an embarrassingly short time, suddenly we're thinking about something else. Our mind has wandered. What do? As soon as we notice, we bring it back. It wanders again, you bring it back. When Krishna explains this to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita about fixing the mind, Arjuna objects. He says it's not possible because the mind is, well, he says, like a hurricane. You talk about a candle in a windless place, and the mind is like a hurricane, you know. It's not possible. And then Krishna says, I understand the problem about the mind. You're right, it's difficult to control the mind. But he says it is possible. And he says, abhyasena vairagyena cha. By abhyasa and by vairagya. Vairagya means detachment. In other words, we try not to engage in those activities that are going to make the mind more turbulent. So that means detachment. Do not become fixated on objects of desire. Do not become, you know, do those things that lust, greed, anger, they decrease. And the other thing is abhyasa. The meaning of abhyasa is repetition or practice. It's like when you're learning a musical instrument, you have to practice every day, which means doing the same thing over and over again. Or any skill, it just requires practice. So that's what Prabhupada has laid down for us when he wants his initiated disciples to chant 16 rounds a day. That's practice. And the practice is not to sit there and go nish, 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 while the mind is wandering everywhere. The practice is that I try with determination to fix my mind on the holy name, and when it goes off, bring it back. And therefore, it's like a fight with the mind. But because we're dealing with Krishna, first of all, if we pay attention to Krishna, he begins to pay attention to us. This is his nature. And so with just the effort, even if it does not seem successful to us, if we just don't quit and keep on trying, we will very soon see something happening. Because we are chanting on the clearing stage when we're trying to become free from this offense. And although the pure name isn't revealed to us, what we are seeing is the dawning light of the holy name, the dawning twilight. The pure name is below the horizon like the sun in the morning, but the sun's light is in the sky. And that is called Nam Abhasa. And Haridas Thakur said that Nam Abhasa, just mere Nam Abhasa, destroys all sinful reactions and brings the devotee to liberation. Then the pure name comes, and then there's Krishna Prema. So although it's only an intermediate state, still just making the effort, as soon as the effort begins, even if it's not so successful, if we just persist. And then if we can just do this, then that will just try. Even if we're so disturbed, just, you know, it's so discouraging, don't get discouraged, just keep trying. Then that will also clear up so many mental problems. Now, some people may be so disturbed they can't even try. Then we have to have something, I don't know what fallback you can do, but at least this is the remedy of how one has to chant the holy names. And it really, because then the potencies of the holy name start to become activated, the dirt and dust start to go away, the whole world changes. Every time, if we're chanting like that, when you open a Bhagavad Gita and start reading it, It sounds like Krishna's telling you just what you need to know. If we're chanting in a careless way, we say, why does Prabhupada keep saying the same thing over and over again? This is so boring. But if that's the way it seems now, if you start chanting like this, it will change completely. And suddenly you'll start understanding what Krishna, at least Krishna will always let us know what he wants us to do next. He may not show us even two steps ahead, but he'll always show us the next step once we show that we're interested in taking it. Otherwise, why should he waste his time? So this is our discipline of Prabhupada in one place calls it japa yoga for clearing things up. Okay. Yeah, deal with the mind. That's the main thing.
I read one place, and even in Ayurveda, they recommend sadhana for mental problems.
Yeah.
That's one of the cures, acting in the mode of goodness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything in the mode of goodness is helpful, actually. Because mental disturbances, ignorance or a combination of ignorance and passion. And so anything to do to make the environment sattvic, pure. You know, if somebody is really a mentally disturbed person, make them clean their room. That'll help. You know, wash the clothes. You know, like eat a nice prasadam. You know, things will change right away. All those things we do that will increase the mode of goodness. Yeah, is useful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I heard that the size of the soul is like 10,000 of a tick of a hair.
Mm-hmm.
Is that then the size in our real size, like in the spiritual world?
No, in the material world. It's not like that. I mean, in the spiritual world, what can I say about size? It's a different idea of size. You're not just dealing with three-dimensional measurements, and you're in relationship with Krishna, and so I mean, it's not. Size is very elastic. but generally it's understood that Krishna's size is he's Vibhu, the great, and we are Anu, the tiny. So very 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 small like that. But in the spiritual world, the soul itself is a spiritual person, and so all the functions of the senses and the mind are originally there in the soul. But when we become a conditioned soul, these things are expressed materially. And Ramanujacharya talks about the soul in the material world. That is, its senses become compacted, you know, like just smashed in together. Because now our hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, walking, talking is all done through the material body. And so the spiritual activities of the soul are dormant. And so the spiritual person we are is in an unmanifest state, really. As we perform devotional service, that spiritual person, our true identity starts to become manifest. We engage these material senses in Krishna service, but at the same time, our spiritual senses become active. So much so that very advanced devotees have two bodies. One is called a siddha-deha, a spiritual body which is engaged in Krishna's pastimes, and a sadhaka-deha, this spiritualized material body that's acting in the material world. That's what will happen. So when the spiritual, when we talk about the form of the soul in the spiritual world, form or body means that all the senses are manifest. A body means an organized arrangement of senses. The Sanskrit word is indriya. Maybe we use the word instruments, because not only are there the instruments for hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling, these are called the karmendriya, the ganendriya, the instruments of knowledge. But we also, in the same category, the karmendriya, the instruments of action. So my two hands, my two legs, my tongue for speaking, these are, and so on. These are another. So if you see all these instruments by which the world comes into us, in which we also act back on the world, all those things together, that's a body. That's what it means to have a body. So Krishna has a spiritual body. Spiritual body means that, and we have a spiritual body, so that here the spirit soul is one thing, the subtle body is another thing, the gross body is another thing. Every time we die, shuffle off the mortal coil, we only shuffle off part of it, the gross body. The spiritual, the subtle body goes with the soul and then gets another gross body. So these things are a little different. The gross body, the subtle body, and the soul. In the spiritual world, there's no difference. They're all spiritual. And so it's a completely unified body. There's no difference between the soul and the body, the mind and the soul, the body and the mind. And also every part can perform all the functions of the whole. These are the descriptions that we have. Yeah.
I don't know if it's important, but just more because I've heard that what I was told is that actually all this time that the soul is in the material world suffering, in the spiritual world is very, very short time.
Yeah.
Like you just away from the second.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm.
But then I'm wondering, like, when you're going, are your soul or the person that you really are in the spiritual world, is it actually leaving physically?
No, they don't physically leave.
They actually stay there always.
Mm-hmm.
So I am there now.
Yeah, but you're kind of absent-minded. But there it's like a, you know, just like 1 second. What was that? Something like. Well, Prabhupada says that we, in the true sense, we never fall. He compares being in the material world to a person who's having a dream. So I say at night, I'm in my bed and I'm having a dream. It's a nightmare. So Prabhupada says, he uses the example that in my dream I'm in the jungle and I'm being chased by a tiger. Now I've created a dream body. And I identify with that dream body. So I'm full of fear. I'm terrified. And the jungle is dark. And the tiger's behind me and coming closer. And I'm running in terror through this jungle. And I'm having a hard way to go because I can't see. And I keep running and tripping over tree roots and getting branches in my face. And so the tiger's getting closer and closer. You know, finally I can hear, his behind. And then it's quiet because he's in the air. And then, I feel the teeth in my neck and smell that rotten meat tiger breath. And I scream in terror and I wake up and I'm safe in bed. You know, there's the moonlight coming into the window there, the curtains blowing in the nice breeze. You know? I was always safe in bed. I never went anywhere else. I was in no jungle. Was I suffering? Well, one sense, yes, and another sense, no. And so Krishna's attitude is like that, you know. It's like your child is having a bad dream. Well, you're not in really anxiety because you know he's okay, but you do try to wake him up. Oh, so it's like that. So the Prabhupada says that in a way we are not falling. We think we're falling. This is the way Prabhupada is that like that. Okay. It's gotten late now. I've talked for a long time. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.